The original podcast was recorded in German. This podcast was translated using artificial intelligence. Burnrate, the Venture Insider podcast with Max Meister and Guy Jafrady.
Hello, welcome to Burnrate, the VC Insider podcast. I'm talking here with Guy Jafrady about the startup scene with a focus on venture capital. We're approaching the 100th episode. We've reached episode 93, and we're recording on Thursday, April 30th at 9 p.m. in the evening. This podcast is sponsored by our partners, Omnium and Upscale.ch. Guy, what are today's topics?
Yes, today in the news, we have how physical AI hubs are developing in Europe and also where we as Switzerland stand. Then we'll look at Apollo's investment in Vardis, or however you pronounce it. And as the third news item, we'll take a look at the new US seed investment data from Crunchbase. In the deep dive, we have Oliver Flückiger from Vibe.vc as a guest. There we'll learn what vibe coding is and how you can invest in this space as a VC. So extremely exciting. I'm really looking forward to what he's going to tell us. And then in the listener question, we received one about how to best start a career in VC. And finally, as always, we've prepared a few transactions for you.
Yes, before we start with the news, an unprepared question once again for you, Guy. What do you think? Who has been the most successful VC worldwide over the last 5 years?
Yes, that's of course a good question. Besides you, it could of course be Andreessen Horowitz or Sequoia, and maybe also First Founder Capital or Founders Fund. Those are always names that perform very well.
Yes, good one. Thank you for the flowers. Unfortunately, it's not me, or at least not yet. It's SBF, namely Sam Bankman-Fried. Just briefly, what he bought through FTX and where the valuations stand today. That's very interesting. For example, Cursor. He invested $200,000 and his stake is now worth $3 billion. That's a performance of, I have to read this, 1,499,900%. Then we have Anthropic, where he invested just under $500 million. That stake is now worth $82 billion. Then SpaceX, he went in with $200 million. Current value of his stake, $15 billion. I don't know, crazy numbers. Solana, he invested $189 million. Now it stands at $5.1 billion. That's a plus of 2,600%. Robinhood, he invested $612 million. His stake is worth $5 billion. And Genesis Digital, he invested $1.17 billion and it's now worth $3.5 billion. So if he hadn't done anything wrong, he'd have around $114 billion in wealth today. And instead, he's sitting in prison in the Federal Correctional Institution and tweeting a bit. That's pretty wild.
Yes, you can say that. Of course, I knew it was him. Or let's assume nobody else has made crazier investments over the last few years. That's a misconception many people have when looking at VC. They look at the big names like A16Z, Sequoia, and so on. But those aren't actually the top performers. They're consistently good, but not the best. The best are often new VCs who take a lot of risk early on and build a name. And maybe for SBF, or rather for the creditors he harmed, they might actually end up with a much better deal now than they ever would have with all the crypto investments they made on his platform. So maybe it turned out quite well for them after all, but we'll definitely read more about that.
Yes, I mean, you'd also have to critically reflect on the court ruling. He was convicted of misappropriation, among other things. And I don't know where all the assets will flow when companies IPO, like SpaceX will in the next few weeks. I assume all investors will receive massive returns and the poor guy is sitting in prison instead, poor in quotation marks. It's proven he didn't act entirely cleanly. On the other hand, if everything goes well, he makes a lot of people very rich. So it's quite a crazy story. We'll definitely hear more about it. Let's move on to the news of the week. In the first Burnrate news, we look at physical AI. As you mentioned, AI that doesn't just produce text, images, or code, but acts in the physical world. For example, robotics, industrial automation, autonomous vehicles, chips, or advanced materials. According to a recent analysis by Sifted, the startup publication of the Financial Times, around 7 billion euros have flowed into European physical AI startups over the past 2 years. Particularly interesting from a Swiss perspective, Zurich ranks second in Europe by number of deals, with 25 deals and 241 million euros in funding. Only London is ahead. guy. Are you surprised that Zurich is already so far ahead in physical AI?
Honestly, not really. I mean, we talk every week about startups and the Swiss venture ecosystem, and Zurich is, of course, a big topic, and physical AI as well. Zurich has top robotics research at ETH and at the same time top AI research through the AI Center. There's so much deep tech talent being trained, and ETH also has a meaningful proximity to industrial companies. That creates extremely strong conditions to take a leading position in physical AI. What surprises me more is that we're already so visible in terms of deal count from the ETH side. In terms of funding, London is far ahead. I didn't note the exact number, but I think it was around 2 billion. That's extremely high, but driven by one or two very large transactions. But the number of deals is increasing, and that points to a solid Swiss ecosystem.
Looking ahead, do you think physical AI could become more important for Switzerland than classic software or consumer AI startups?
Yes, absolutely. I would almost sign that. Switzerland isn't exactly the obvious place for a huge consumer platform, with maybe someday 10 million people. We're relatively small. But where we are extremely strong is engineering, precision, industry, medtech, and robotics. And physical AI plays a major role in all of those areas. I do believe that the most exciting Swiss AI startups will come from the combination of AI and the real world, much more so than the next chatbot app coming out of Switzerland.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to a second piece of news, a new Swiss unicorn. Vivardis, a dental medtech company from Zug, has received a strategic minority investment from various funds managed by Apollo. The valuation is apparently over $1 billion. Vivardis is now one of the few privately held European healthcare unicorns. The company develops Curodont, a non-invasive treatment for early-stage cavities. Instead of drilling and filling, the technology repairs enamel and stops early decay. According to the company, Curodont has already been used on around 3 million teeth in the US and is present in almost 20% of general dental practices. That's quite impressive. What's interesting is this isn't a classic software case, but a Swiss deep tech and med tech company scaling through research, clinical evidence, and strong commercialization. Guy, are you surprised that a dental med tech company from Zug has reached unicorn status?
No, not really. And now I also know it's pronounced Vivardis. That makes sense. Thanks, Max. I mean, dental med tech isn't one of the loud startup sectors, but there's a lot of innovation happening there. And Switzerland is right at the forefront. We see that again with this transaction. We have strong research, excellent medtech know-how, regulatory quality, and Vivardis addresses one of the biggest global problems. Cavities are extremely widespread. If you haven't had one by our age, hey, you've brushed well. Haribo makes children happy, and dentists too, you could say. And offering a treatment without drilling is a huge market and a big win for customers. It's not always the most pleasant experience. Max, what's the most important point for you in this news? The $1 billion valuation, the Apollo investment, or the rapid adoption in the US?
Yes, I've been thinking about that. I think it's the adoption in the US. A valuation is important, but ultimately it's just a signal. What matters is the product actually being used? If Curodont has already been used in millions of treatments and is established in many dental practices, that shows not just research, but real commercial scaling. And that's what makes the case so compelling. Then we analyze the latest data on the VC seed market in the US. These trends often lead Europe. According to Crunchbase, seed funding in the US has not collapsed. That's good news. But it is changing significantly. Smaller pre-seed and seed rounds between $200,000 and $5 million declined by around 20% in 2025. At the same time, large seed rounds are growing significantly. Particularly interesting, in 2025, more than half of US seed capital went into rounds of $10 million or more. Just to remember, these are seed or pre-seed rounds. A few years ago, seed was much more characterized by smaller tickets. Today, we see a kind of split. Either a startup has an extremely strong AI team, very fast growth, well-known founders, then it can raise huge seed rounds. or it belongs to the large group for which fundraising has become much harder. You could say it's never been easier to build a product and never harder to build a business. Guy, does Seed still exist as we know it? Or is it partly already a disguised Series A?
Yes. I mean, for the large AI rounds, it really doesn't feel like classic seed financing anymore. When a startup raises 10, 20, or 50 million, or even more, as we've often seen in the last 2 years, it's no longer about building a first product. It's about speed, executing the idea, hiring talent, often also computing capacity. That's extremely expensive even early on. And it's about capturing the market as quickly and broadly as possible. That's more like blitz scaling at seed, which used to happen in Series A after product validation. Max, what does this mean for regular founders who aren't ex-OpenAI, DeepMind, or Stanford elite teams?
I think they need to show much more clearly why they will win. A very tight customer focus, strong distribution, real willingness to pay, and maybe an unfair advantage in a market. A good AI product alone is no longer enough, especially since many can now quickly build an MVP. We'll also hear this in the interview with Olli Flückiger. The question becomes more important. Who can turn it into a real business? That's the key question, and that's where the wheat will be separated from the chaff.
With Omnium, you close your financing round faster and more successfully. Our partner Omnium is an innovative platform for growth financing. Omnium is the one-stop shop for financing rounds because they offer a completely digital, lean, and cost-efficient process, including legal framework, investor, KYC, and payment processing. If you raise with Omnium, you have the choice to do a private round and use only the platform for your investment opportunity. Or you choose the Private Round Plus, with additional access to 10,000 registered investors. If you want a public-facing round with the broadest possible reach, you choose the Public Round, where the offer is made accessible to all investors. With Omnium, you close your financing round faster and more successfully. Do you want to scale your startup quickly and successfully and not just grow? Then the Upscaler program is exactly the right thing for you. It gives you access to our large pool of founders, entrepreneurs, and suitable investors. More than 50 startups have already benefited in more than 500 workshops and scaled their business nationally and internationally. Do you also want to benefit from this personal and individual support? You'll find all information at www.upscaler.ch.
Let's get to today's main topic. Today we're speaking with Oliver Flückiger from Vibe VC, an early investor for a new generation of startups, namely companies that use AI tools, vibe coding, and agent-native workflows to build, test, and further develop products in an extremely short time. What interests us most is how early-stage investing changes when an MVP no longer takes months, but sometimes only days. What really matters then? The idea, the product, distribution, data, or is it the founders behind it? With Olli, we'll look at how Vibe VC is structured, which startups are investable for them, which signals they use instead of classic pitch decks, and where the biggest opportunities, but also the red flags, are with Vibe-coded companies. Just a few words about Olli. As is well known, he's an old hand in the Swiss startup ecosystem. Olli is a tech entrepreneur, has been working for many years on digital business models, platforms, startups, and entrepreneurship, and is also active as a lecturer, speaker, and board member. Welcome to Burn Rate, Olli.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Hi, everyone.
Hello, Olli. Let's go straight into the questions. Let's start briefly with the structure and hypothesis of Vibe VC.
What exactly do you do and how are you structured? So as a classic VC fund with investors in the background, or did you choose a different model there? Maybe you can also say something about the target portfolio size and the number of startups you want to invest in and ticket sizes.
A lot of questions at once. I'll start with what we do. So we are a super early stage investor. Our idea is that we invest as the very first investor in vibe coded or precisely agentic engineered projects. And why we do that? We asked ourselves how venture capital reacts to agentic engineering and whether early stage investments are even still needed at all when the speed of bringing a new product to market rises so massively and costs fall massively at the same time. So today with Claude Code, you can program an MVP in the shortest possible time. With many AI tools, you can create a brilliant marketing strategy super quickly. Is venture capital even still needed? And we believe yes, but that it also changes a lot, that as a VC, you mainly have to finance customer contact, that first validation, and no longer the development. In addition, we believe that pitch decks today are all made with AI anyway and all look great, have super great content. So as a startup, you can no longer really differentiate yourself there either. And then we asked ourselves, yes, what should you look at today as an early stage investor? And we thought about founding a micro VC that operates an MCP server, so one that can be very easily integrated into the agentic engineering environment via an MCP server. We then essentially look over the developer's shoulders at what they are doing. And if we find a project interesting, then we invest. We make small tickets. So that can already be on the second or third day of a project. And those can then be four-figure, five-figure ticket sizes for the moment. You also asked how we are financed. At the moment, the three of us are doing this privately, but we can well imagine raising a real fund at a later point.
That sounds extremely exciting. And what does a vibe-coded startup have to show today for you to say, yes, this is investable now? You said it's extremely early on the second or third day. What are the topics you look at?
Yes, that is also a very good question. I think part of it is classic, or there has to be a very clear problem, a clear customer problem. The total addressable market definitely has to be large enough. So it can't just be anything vibe coded, but rather, like Andre Karpathy now said, agentic engineered. So already a larger project than just a small app that doesn't solve a problem, then there should somehow already be a market entry strategy. So an idea of how you want to go to market, and ideally the very first traction signals that we see. That doesn't have to be first customers or anything yet, but it could be GitHub stars or a LinkedIn post that goes viral, maybe first traffic on the landing page, something where you simply see there are first signals from the market.
You said you invest small tickets, right? That came across clearly. What role does this capital play specifically? So does it then have to be used in a very earmarked way, or are the projects free there?
So I think basically the projects are free in how they use the money, but of course it should be about validating the product, reaching first users. So what you do with early stage capital, I think for founder speed, for example, you probably don't need money anymore today. With Claude Code, you are extremely fast enough.
Now, if MVPs can be built in days, how do you recognize whether there is real founder quality behind a product and not just simply a well-made prompt or a demo?
Yes. So I think today it takes hours rather than days to vibe code something. And it's a very good question, which we also have not yet answered conclusively. I think that the whole Vibe VC, that is also an experiment for us. We still have to learn an enormous amount, but we definitely look at the market size, as I said earlier, at traction. And we certainly also want to see how the founder's vibe code. So what the prompts look like, what exactly they are doing there. We then look at analytics, want access, for example, to Posthog, where we can see traction a bit, and of course also other GitHub repositories of the founders. So if there are a lot of wasted repositories where nothing is being done anymore, then of course the probability is high that nothing will continue with the latest project either.
So you look extremely closely at the data and the code that was written. Do you then also meet the founders and have meetings the way a VC does, or is it simply looking under the hood and you don't look at the car from the outside at all?
I think our decisions will be made very quickly. It may be that we still do a call with the founders, but it may also be that we immediately make an investment offer. We don't focus on Switzerland, but actually are or would invest internationally. And yes, it can, of course, very well be that we never get to know the founders at all.
And you also replace the classic pitch deck, as you mentioned, through your MCP server. That is extremely exciting.
We will replace the pitch deck theater, basically.
Yes, exactly. And which signals from the vibe coding environment are for the investment decision? You already said a bit. What is especially meaningful, and how do you also get to the people? Today, people send a pitch deck everywhere via LinkedIn, and of course, they don't all know your server yet.
That is also a good question. We are trying to get traction ourselves, as is, of course, the case as a new investor. That's why I'm here with you today. Yes, I think there is a flood of vibe-coded apps, and it is really important that we get a good selection. But I can really also imagine that people create fundable projects who today have absolutely no access or route to venture capital. So that could be, I don't know, a 16-year-old student, school student who program something super cool and who would never get capital today, who then gets first funding from us, and how we ourselves want to get to the startups. Yes, we are also doing it analogously to hopefully our startups set up an open claw that does marketing for us, of course, also through our contacts ourselves. But we are, of course, trying ourselves to use AI as intensively as possible.
Yes, marketed by agents for agents is also an interesting approach.
Yes, exactly.
And listening to you, many products that are being vibe coded now will hardly get much attention. And you weight distribution and customer access compared to the product and the technology. What are really the key criteria there for how you can assess that such early traction also counts, and not that it is then overtaken from the left and right and then shut down?
Yes, I think you can't. I don't know whether one can say that conclusively. I always believe that there must first be traction. But of course, as is always the case with early stage investments, it can happen that you are simply overtaken on the left or right. It can. So in the end, it is also simply an investment in the founders whom we have to believe in some form.
What are the typical red flags for you in vibe-coded startups, even if the product looks good and works at first glance? Where do you see possible risks there?
I think that also changes every day. So at the moment, it's certainly security risks that are somewhere in there. But I think that is still a matter of weeks until vibe code apps are much more secure than manually programmed apps. Then I think it a red flag is definitely if no problem is being solved. So a customer problem also has to be solved today and in 10 years. Otherwise, it will simply never be used. And if we don't understand that, then we don't continue.
Mm-hmm. What would still really interest me is how, in your opinion, does the role of an early stage VC now change through agent-native startups? Does the VC become more of a pure capital provider? Is data analysis becoming essential? Does he become a product coach, I can well imagine, or a pure distribution partner?
Yes, maybe everything. I think that is also part of our hypothesis that we still want to test. As I said, we do believe that the VC or early stage VC is mainly there to enable speed, market access, and that as an early stage investor, you basically start directly with due diligence, that it is much more data-driven and the pitch deck will probably not disappear, but it will have much less relevance in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So we do believe that you remain a capital provider. Product coach, yes, I don't know. AI can probably do that better than any VC today. And data analysis, yes, in the end, actually also. The only thing it still cannot do is provide the capital.
Yes, that is correct. Now, if you fast forward 12 months into the future, where will you be then?
I have no idea. It may be that we no longer exist at all. It may be that we have raised a fund. It may be that we have simply made somehow 10, 20 investments. I don't know. I don't even know where we will be in 3 months, because we simply also don't know which models will be on the market in 3 months, whether the whole AI bubble has burst. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Ollie, thank you very much for visiting Burn Rate. We're keeping our fingers crossed for you, think it's a great project, and hope it works out well. All the best.
Thank you very much.
Let's get to the listener question. We received a listener question from Steffi from Fribourg. She asks herself, how do you actually become a good VC investor? And is going directly into venture capital really the best path to get there? Yes, that's of course an interesting question, Steffi, because from the outside, VC often looks like a relatively clear career. Maybe you start as an analyst or associate, work your way up, build a network, make good deals, and eventually become a partner. But in practice, it is often much more complicated. VC funds are very small organizations, like, for example, with us at Koyo as well. There are only a few real partner roles, and not every career step is as standardized as in consulting or banking. On top of that, junior roles in VC may sound attractive, but they don't always automatically offer the experiences that later make someone a strong investor. Because the decisive question is not only, can I analyze markets, read decks, and assess founders well, but also, do I really understand how startups work? Have I experienced how difficult hiring, product focus, sales, fundraising, cash management, or a pivot can be? And can I actually help founders in that situation? Yes. And above all, am I able to raise funds? That is also very, very important there. Steffi's question, therefore, actually goes in two directions. So should one enter VC as early as possible, or is it wiser to first gather operational experience in a startup? And what would funds actually have to do to really develop young talent into good VCs? Yes, Guy, would you say that anyone who wants to be successful in venture capital long term should first gain startup experience themselves as a founder or as an operator or in an early team role?
I mean, that is certainly an added value for this path. It gives the profile the first steps toward becoming a VC, because VC is not a purely analytical job. Of course, you have to understand markets, be able to assess business models, and also build, take apart, and question investment cases. But in the end, you invest in companies that have to grow under extreme uncertainty and where an enormous number of puzzle pieces have to fit together. And there a lot of experience and gut feeling is involved in the very early phase until it gets into, let's say, Series A, where you can then use more numbers, customer conversations, and a bit more data. And someone who has worked in a startup understands many things much more intuitively. How hard is it to find good people? I mean, that is an enormous pain. In a startup, you have almost no capital to pay good salaries. And so you somehow have to motivate people to come to you and actually accept a lower salary. Then you suddenly understand, if you have worked in a startup, how chaotic many product decisions can be and how long sales cycles really take. They are not simply the 6 weeks written on the pitch deck just because one customer once managed it. Sometimes it is simply months until the first client, sometimes even years. Then what it is like to pivot, also incredibly good experience. And then, yes, how quickly a runway of a few months suddenly feels extremely short, because you suddenly simply stand in front of the cliff and have to decide what comes next. These are experiences you can make in a startup and not necessarily in VC, but I would also say that not every VC has to have been a founder before or worked in a startup, but operational experience often gives you a bit more empathy and a better sense of which problems are really critical and which simply look big on paper and are maybe made big in the startup's pitch. And especially in Europe, I do think it is important to bring in a bit of startup experience, a bit of operator know-how, if you want to call it that. We have an enormous number of smart investors with backgrounds in consulting, banking, and the corporate world. That can definitely be valuable, but when a fund simply has too little operational experience in the team, or generally too little experience in the investment space, then there is a real danger of analyzing startups very much like normal companies, basically like established firms, and then not really understanding enough how these startups emerge, how they grow, and where the dynamics lie. And I mean, you can also say at Kojo Max, you and I, we have completely different profiles and career paths. I am more the one who, after studying and doing a postdoc, gained a bit of operational experience in quasi startups, but then relatively quickly moved on to an investor track. And you are clearly much more the operator, built and exited your own companies. And I do think a good balance is important there so that you can look at cases quickly and well and always be honest in the team. That is important.
Yes, many young people think I'll go directly to a VC fund after university or after 1 or 2 years of work experience and then work my way up. From your perspective, is that a realistic career path?
Yes, I mean, it can be realistic. You see people who have done it, but you have to look at it soberly. VC, as you mentioned, is not the same career architecture as, for example, in consulting, which we are very often compared to a bit. In most funds, there is no clean pyramid where every year or every 2 years, a certain number of people are promoted and there are very clear levels and goals for how to become an associate or a principal. That basically doesn't exist in most VC funds. The fund teams are too small and the organization is extremely flat. As you also mentioned, there are very few partner seats. Then in the final step, you really also have to deal with being able to fundraise and having the network not only on the startup side, but also on the investor side, so on the LP side. And yes, becoming a partner doesn't just mean taking on more responsibility, but also receiving the economics, the carry, and the decision rights. And there, you are not only deciding over your own money, but also over the money of the investors. And there, you do look at it a bit differently when you make an investment decision than when you are basically an employee of a fund. And I mean, these decision rights and the carry that existing partners don't automatically share either. And I would just put it out there. Maybe you see it that way too, Max. Maybe you see it differently. If you want to become a partner GP of a fund, then that can easily take 8 to 10 years in a fund, because maybe you are only a GP by the third or fourth fund once you have become a functionary there. And yes, for junior investors, it is therefore crucial when looking at a position to ask yourself, do I get real deal responsibility? Am I allowed to build topics myself? Will I be visible in successful investments? So will I be mentioned in media releases? Do I have access to founders, to the LPs? Can I also help make portfolio decisions? Or am I actually mainly active in screening and research mode? And if the latter is the case, then you can learn a lot and very quickly. But that does not automatically put you on the path to partnership. And then a move from VC to a startup or specialization in a specific topic can be extremely valuable long term. We see that very often as well, that junior VCs up to associate level move into a startup and then spend a few years there. Then they come back as investors with much, much more experience. So my advice here would be, anyone entering VC as a junior should very consciously check whether the fund really develops talent or whether it is simply a stepping stone. And you have to be aware of what you're getting into here. Max, what would you advise someone who says today, I want to become a partner in a VC fund in 5 to 10 years? What is the best path here in your eyes?
I would first tell him not to optimize too much for the title venture capitalist or general partner, but rather to optimize for building a perspective that will later be truly valuable for a fund. That can be operational startup experience, for example, in growth, sales, product, talent, finance, or strategy. If you work close enough to the decisive questions in a good startup, you learn an enormous amount about how companies are really built. But it can also be deep domain expertise. If someone really knows their way around, for example, climate, health, defense, that can be enormously valuable for specialized funds. Precisely because good investors don't just have to recognize generically exciting founders, but must understand earlier in specific markets what is becoming possible. Direct entry into VC can, of course, work. You said that too, but then I would pay very close attention to whether you only make PowerPoints and complete or conduct screening, or whether you actually get ownership. So your own theses, your own founder relationships, your own deals, real portfolio work. And for VC funds, my point would be, if you want young talent, you also have to treat them like future investors, not just as analytical capacity. That means clear development paths, fair deal attribution, access to decision-making processes, and real responsibility. In the end, you don't become a good VC by only talking about startups. You become better by being close enough to real companies, real markets, and real founder problems. And that is exactly what you should seek as early as possible in your career.
Thank you very much, Steffi, for the exciting question. Always a good topic to explore a bit, where you stand and how you get to where you actually stand now. And maybe just to say here as well at Kojo, we keep receiving exciting profiles. Of course, we always look at them in detail and also give feedback. But currently, we are not in the process of expanding the team. So you shouldn't get your hopes up too much right away. So let's get to the transactions of the week. Last week, we again saw several exciting transactions, and we have briefly summarized the most important ones here for you.
Yes, exactly. Let's start with the robotics startup Bubble Robotics from Dubendorf near Zurich. They were founded in 2025 and have now closed a pre-seed round of $5 million. The round was led by Episode One Ventures, Astorian Ventures, and Norskan Evolve. The company comes out of the Entrepreneur First program and also has locations in France and San Francisco.
Bubble Robotics is building a fleet of autonomous robotic systems for continuous use at sea, so in the ocean. instead of carrying out individual missions with ships, crews, and heavy equipment, the systems are supposed to remain permanently in the sea and carry out inspections, monitoring, and data collection there 24/7, 365 days. At its core, it is about turning expensive, punctual offshore operations into permanent autonomous infrastructure.
I looked at this more closely. The customers are wherever offshore infrastructure has to be monitored, for example, in maritime security, subsea infrastructure, in ports, of course, as well, energy companies, and for example, also operators of undersea cables. These assets in particular are becoming more important, but often remain not monitored in real time. Bubble already speaks of letters of intent worth more than $4 million and planned deployments in the offshore wind sector, maritime security, and subsea infrastructure.
Yes, of course, that is an interesting timing aspect they are finding here. A topic that has been increasingly in the media at the moment or over the past few years, when looking at global infrastructure and offshore operations are simply really extremely expensive, dangerous, hard to scale. And at the same time, there is an acute structural labor shortage in this area. And on top of that, critical maritime infrastructures have moved much more strongly into the geopolitical spotlight, as I mentioned here. So Bubble is not simply selling an underwater robot, but a new model of robotics as a service at sea for permanent presence in the ocean.
The capital is supposed to flow into building this autonomous robot fleet and into the first commercial deployments. The robotics as a service approach is essential here because customers do not need high initial investments or their own offshore mobilization. Strategically, it is about bringing the tech out of the early development phase into real deployments and thereby building a new autonomous infrastructure layer for the ocean.
Let's move to the next transaction. This time it's not about a financing round, but about an asset and patent deal. BV, a company from the Swiss Jura, has acquired the assets and patents of 9T Labs. 9T Labs, as most of you probably know, has been in bankruptcy and liquidation since November 2025. We also reported on that. It is a Zurich deep tech startup for additive manufacturing with continuous carbon fibers. So BV is taking over the technology and machines from a restructuring situation.
9T Labs developed a technology that enables high-strength composite components with up to 60% continuous carbon fiber content and precise fiber alignment to be manufactured additively. BV is now continuing this tech under the name NeoCarp. The most important claim is components can be twice as strong and up to 70% lighter than titanium, so exactly where weight and performance are decisive.
BV wants to bring NeoCarp primarily into the watch industry, aerospace, mobility, and medtech. That fits very well with their origin in the Jura. This region is extremely strongly rooted in precision industry and watchmaking, and at the same time, the technology also shows great potential beyond that wherever highly load-bearing components are needed.
Yes, BV plans to invest several million francs in a new technology center, which could already open in 2027. There, the acquired machines are to be used and NeoCarp further developed for industrial applications. Strategically, this is therefore less of a classic exit and more of an industrial utilization of deep tech IP with the aim of turning the tech from 9T Labs into market-ready components for demanding industries. With the third transaction, we go to Lucerne. Bug Bounty Switzerland is a Lucerne cybersecurity startup founded in 2020. Now the company has completed a Series A round of 12 million Swiss francs. The round was led by Direttissima Growth Partners with participation from Deutsche Beteiligungs AG.
Bug Bounty Switzerland, they want to build an AI-supported cyber resilience shield for continuous cybersecurity testing. The platform combines AI orchestration, proprietary testing contests, offensive AI agents, and a vetted global community of more than 16,000 ethical hackers. The core is moving away from one-off penetration tests toward ongoing measurable test coverage of the entire exposed attack surface.
The company is already profitable and works with more than 50 enterprise customers. These include financial institutions, global consumer goods brands, operators of critical infrastructure, and also public sector bodies. Particularly relevant is that the Federal Office for Cybersecurity, BACS, is also among its customers, which is a strong trust signal in this market.
What is perhaps also worth mentioning about the round is quite interesting. This is Series A. One usually assumes that a seed and pre-seed round had been raised before. That is not the case here. Bug Bounty bootstrapped and has actually grown profitably up to now, and this is its first external financing round. The fresh capital therefore marks the transition from a self-financed founder-led company to an internationally scaling cybersecurity scale-up, or that is at least what they plan with this financing round. And of course, the timing fits very well. Cloud, SaaS, APIs, and AI-generated code. That continuously increases the attack surface. We have heard an enormous amount in the news in recent weeks about what Claude Code and the new models can now do. And of course, attackers also use that to find vulnerabilities faster and intervene.
We also asked ourselves what the game plan is. The capital is to flow into three areas. On the one hand, international expansion, the expansion of AI-supported and increasingly autonomous orchestration of security tests, and also team growth. The founders will continue to retain the majority, and Direttissima partner Philip Bolliger will join the board of directors. Strategically, it is therefore about turning a profitable Swiss specialist into a European player for continuous cyber resilience.
So with the last transaction, we also include an exit on the program. Polariton Technologies, a Swiss photonics startup, was acquired by the US semiconductor company Marvell Technology. Unfortunately, as so often, the financial details were not disclosed. It would have been extremely exciting to get a bit of insight here. Strategically, the deal fits exactly into the context of the AI data center boom, where ever higher bandwidths and more energy-efficient optical connections are needed.
Yes, Polariton develops, I have to read this here, plasmonics-based silicon photonics components. In particular, high-speed modulators for optical data transmission. Put simply, it is about converting electrical signals into optical signals extremely quickly and energy efficiently. The tech is supposed to enable higher density, more parallel optical links, and very low energy consumption per bit. Exactly what modern AI and cloud data centers need.
The customers are providers of data centers, cloud, and optical interconnect infrastructure. Through the acquisition, Polariton's technology now becomes part of Marvell's platform for high-speed connectivity. Fits extremely well. The relevant market, these are applications, data center interconnect, scalar cross connections, and the next generation of 1.6, 3.2 terabit, and also optical networks beyond that.
What's interesting is that Polariton sits exactly at one of the central bottlenecks of AI infrastructure. Data has to be moved ever faster and more energy efficiently in data centers. Marvell is a major player, it has to be said, in data infrastructure semiconductors, with revenue of more than $8 billion. And they are buying not just IP here, but also a highly specialized engineering team. For me, this is a good example of how Swiss deep tech can be integrated into global semiconductor roadmaps.
Of course, it is nice that there has been an exit here, but also a pity. Once again, a tech very likely sold early overall for Marvell. They are strengthening their portfolio around electro-optics, photonics, and switching custom silicon. For Polariton, or for the team, it is, of course, also positive. They now have entry into a global industrial platform. Marvell has an extremely good reputation in this sector, and now they can potentially bring the tech into commercial products much faster. Strategically, a clear AI infrastructure exit from the Swiss deep tech scene. So congrats to everyone who worked on this.
That is a good closing word, Guy. That was it for Burn Rate, the VC Insider podcast. If you want to support our podcast, subscribe to the newsletter and share it in your network. Thank you very much for listening. We wish you a nice weekend. Take care and goodbye.